Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by National Bank of Alaska for convenience in banking, and by Mark Air and Mark Air Express.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. President Bush today announced increased federal involvement in the Exxon oil spill cleanup, making everyone happier but leaving people on the front lines wondering just what that federal support will amount to and when they'll see it. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, the focus of attention is shifting to the southwest, where Kodiak is bracing for oil that may be less than 10 miles away. Calling the Exxon Valdez oil spill a tragic environmental disaster, President George Bush today announced a greater federal role in the cleanup, promising stepped-up aid from the military and federal agencies. In doing so, he repeatedly stressed Exxon's liability for the damages and the imperative for a total cleanup.
Our ultimate goal must be the complete restoration of the ecology and the economy of Prince William Sound, including all of its fish, marine mammals, birds, and other wildlife. The Exxon Corporation has acknowledged responsibility for this spill and its liability for the damages. Exxon should remain responsible for both damages and for employing civilian personnel necessary to control further damage. However, Exxon's efforts, standing alone, are not enough. And after consulting with the congressional delegation, Senator Ted Stevens, Senator Frank Murkowski, Congressman Don Young, I have determined to add additional federal resources to the cleanup effort, in addition to the considerable federal personnel and equipment already on the scene. And this new effort will focus on the job of helping recover oil now in the water and restoring beaches and other damaged areas. This effort should not in any way relieve Exxon from any of its responsibilities or its liabilities.
The president said he's sending Admiral Paul Yost, the commandant of the Coast Guard, back to Alaska to assume personal oversight of the cleanup operation.
Also at my direction, Defense Secretary Dick Cheney will make available U.S. Armed Forces personnel and equipment to assist in the cleanup. The military will provide personnel for direct cleanup activities, as well as assisting with logistics, the needs of logistics related to the cleanup.
Bush also said that he's calling on EPA Administrator William Riley to take charge of long-range planning to restore the environment of the Sound, including the development of programs for using volunteer workers. The president said a loan program will be developed to help mitigate the economic damages to Alaskans and added that he's encouraged Exxon to step up its local hire for the cleanup. Noting that the Exxon spill demonstrated the inadequacy of existing contingency plans, Bush said he's ordered a review of all such plans nationwide. During the question and answer session with reporters, the president maintained his support for oil development and especially for exploration in Anwar. The Alaska Congressional delegation met with reporters in Washington Day following President Bush's nationally televised announcement on the administration's stepped-up role in the cleanup. Washington correspondent Matt Kay has the story.
The delegation said it had gotten most of what it wanted from the administration, short of an emergency declaration by the president. That could still come later, but with the military now involved, the delegation agrees not much more can be accomplished if Bush declares an emergency. Senator Frank Murkowski.
The fact that we have the military participation of the Air Force, the National Guard, under the auspices of the Coast Guard is appropriate, and the ability now to mobilize Alaskans, mobilize volunteers, bring our native firefighters down, people who want to become involved in the actual mopping up exercise.
But amid the satisfaction over Washington's expanded role in the cleanup, there is still uncertainty over the full extent of Exxon's financial liability. Exxon officials testified before Congress this week they are responsible for all reasonable costs of the cleanup. But Murkowski argued Exxon's liability could extend further than the company wants to admit.
There's almost $300 million in the pipeline liability fund, of which there is a provision that up to $100 million can be drawn per incident. But that's no ironclad requirement. There's reason to believe that they can go beyond that. We happen to know that Exxon has $400 million in a pool for cleanup. Those are identifiable amounts that you can look on before you look to Exxon itself.
And Senator Ted Stevens says flatly Exxon's liability is unlimited, but he admits White House lawyers are still looking at the liability question, which could also impact on whether the president ever declares an emergency. Such an action could limit Exxon's financial obligations, which neither the delegation or the administration wants to see. And then there's the political price to be paid for the Exxon Valdez disaster. The president told reporters, you don't stop offshore oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico because of human error causing a tanker spill in Prince William Sound. Congressman Don Young was asked whether Bush's remark will heighten the debate over development proposals for ANWR.
The critics against ANWR, they're not new. They just had a better platform. In fact, some of them actually relished this disaster and actually conveyed that information and that type of conduct and that attitude, which does not surprise me. But yesterday in our House hearing, we had 42 members there. Only two of the total House shut their eyes to the need of a developing ANWR.
Young says the oil spill has actually increased understanding in Congress of the need for development. Says members now know what just a 15-day disruption does to the flow of Alaskan oil to the lower 48. It has brought home the extent of Alaska's oil contribution, 25% of all U.S. needs. But the oil spill has also strained political relationships at a time when cooperation is needed. Stevens blew up when told that Valdez Mayor John Devens complained Bush's announcement shows if Alaskan fishermen want relief from the administration, they should join the Army.
This is not politics. For someone to say that, I think, is really damaging what we're trying to do. And I hope he comes to see me. As a matter of fact, he's complained I didn't go to see him when I was Valdez. He thought I ought to go to his office rather than go out and see the spill. I'm not going to put up with petty politicians in this effort.
Senator Murkowski, trying to calm tempers, argued the delegation is attempting to get the word out that help is available, including low-interest, long-term small business loans for fishermen, and that Bush is acting in good faith. He urged the name-calling and finger-pointing end, and that everyone start to pick up the pieces after a terrible tragedy. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Matt Kay in Washington, D.C.
Governor Cooper was in Juneau, home sick with the flu when the president made his announcement. The governor said military equipment may be the most valuable asset the federal government can offer right now. Later, the troops can hit the beaches. John Greeley spoke with the governor this afternoon.
That's an even better response than we had expected, to tell you the truth.
Cooper asked for the Coast Guard to step in on Wednesday. Late yesterday, he says Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner called to tell him that the president was mobilizing the military and sending Admiral Paul Yost of the Coast Guard to Alaska to oversee the stepped-up effort personally.
I think that Admiral Yost's presence on the scene is going to make a lot of difference in this.
The governor says he was also encouraged by Bush's statement that any military used in the cleanup of Prince William Sound would not displace Alaska workers.
We also have firefighting crews who are available and accustomed to living out in the bush and accustomed to working together on disasters. They are at the ready, and I would certainly want to deploy those firefighters before we go to the military.
But before anybody hits the beaches, be they Alaska firefighters, U.S. military, or civilian volunteers, Cooper says the main problem is retrieving oil from the water, and that process is going painfully slow. Earlier this week, two cleanup officials were dispatched to Tokyo to examine a big Soviet oil cleanup vessel that may be able to reach large patches of crude thought to be submerged to depths of 90 feet under the surface of the water.
We wanted to send both those gentlemen to Tokyo and then have the Soviets come and pick them up in Tokyo and bring them to Sakhalin Island. But Sakhalin Island is a big military installation for the Soviets. They probably are a little nervous about any Americans getting there, and so they wanted both these men to go to Moscow first, which takes another day or two out of their schedule, means that the vessel ultimately will be deployed a couple of days later than before. It will take 9 to 14 days for the vessel to get from Sakhalin Island to Prince William Sound in any event, but I can tell you the oil's still going to be there.
And Cooper himself is housebound these days, hit with the worst case of the flu he said he's seen in 10 years. On the 19th of April, though, the governor said he plans to travel to Washington for a congressional hearing on oil tanker safety legislation. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
On the front lines of the cleanup effort in Prince William Sound, reaction to the president's announcement that he's sending the troops in has been largely one of surprise and confusion. Peter Kenyon reports from Valdez.
The state's top man in Valdez, DEC Commissioner Denny Kelso, says the details of the federal assistance are few and far between at this point, but the state's efforts are moving ahead unchanged.
We don't intend for the announcement that military personnel will be available here to change our momentum at all. We're going to keep our focus. We're going to keep working with local people. We don't know how long it will take for the military staff that the president referred to arrive or to do their assessment, but we're not going to sit back. We're going to continue our work.
According to Coast Guard spokesperson Rick Might, that initial assessment is already underway. Might says General Thomas McInerney arrived from Elmendorf Air Force Base Friday morning to meet with Coast Guard Admiral Nelson and determine what's needed and what can be delivered. Other than that, details are sketchy. Might says it could be as a few days before any hardware or personnel actually arrives in Prince William Sound, and he cautions that this is a tricky situation. You can't just tell the troops to walk out there and start scrubbing rocks, he says, because you don't want a sudden influx of people to harm the sound's ecology any more than it already has been. Exxon officials spent much of Friday morning denying that the president's announcement amounted to a condemnation of the company's cleanup efforts so far. Spokesperson Don Cornett told reporters that Exxon has always worked closely with the Coast Guard, and he doesn't think this is a significant change. Meanwhile, rumors flashed through Valdez Friday afternoon that cleanup workers were being laid off because the military was coming in to take the jobs away. That proved not to be the case. DEC's spill response coordinator Jim Hayden says it's true some people have been let go, but not because of the troops.
We aren't hiring at the moment because we don't have the management personnel. And in fact, we have released about a dozen individuals from the ferry Aurora, which we have out at Sawmill Bay, because we have found that 60 on board is just too many to handle. We're running out of supplies and water too quickly. So we've cut that back to about 35 to 40.
President Bush's statement declared that the troops would not displace any civilian workers. But some of the people here are skeptical. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Peter Kenyon.
As the oil spill spreads into the Gulf of Alaska, the resources to fight it are being sent to Seward, Kodiak, and other threatened communities. From Valdez, Claire Richardson reports on the emergency plans and on an agreement for funding the oil spill defense.
The Battle of Sawmill Bay continues, with heavy Navy sea boom being placed as a fifth line of defense to keep San Juan Salmon Hatchery oil-free. While efforts remain focused on the hatcheries, the Department of Environmental Conservation and Exxon have sent key people to other communities such as Seward, whose front yard, Resurrection Bay, is threatened. DEC's Gary Hayden helped design the emergency team response for those communities.
We have executed sort of memorandums of agreements with Cordova, Kenai Peninsula Borough that will be acting for Seward and possibly those along the coast. And then we also have an agreement with, signed agreement with Kodiak. And those agreements define that the state will assist the communities in reimbursement of their expenses in response mechanisms. And like Commissioner said, we'll be sending technical people there also to talk about oil spill response. And the governor's office has dispatched personnel also to those places. And Fish and Game has been activated in Kodiak also.
Exxon has also begun to deploy boom and other resources to the threatened areas. Exxon Shipping President Frank Iarossi.
We've deployed over 160,000 feet of boom. And we have an additional 120,000 feet en route to Alaska. 30,000 feet of that boom is moving westward to the Seward area, Homer area, and Kodiak. We have a total of 29 skimmers that are either in operation or being deployed from Valdez. We have five others that are being moved westward towards Seward. There's one in Seward, two going to Homer, and two going to Kodiak. So we're beginning to move our resources westward to counter the potential threat from the oil that's in the Gulf of Alaska.
But even with the active involvement of the communities and state and federal officials, DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso says realistically the defense measures in place won't protect the coastline from a strong southeasterly wind.
If there are strong onshore winds for a sustained period of time, we would expect, again, significant impact. It depends to some extent on what form the oil is in if it contacts the shore, and it depends on which areas have defensive protection and how effective that is. So obviously we can't give you a specific answer, but there is no way that that full curve of coastline on the Gulf of Alaska can be adequately protected.
According to Lynn Crystal with the National Weather Service in Valdez, a southeasterly onshore wind is forecast for the weekend. This could affect the areas from Kodiak to southern Prince William Sound. But Crystal adds the winds should be light, and the winds should revert to a northerly offshore direction by early Monday. In Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
The main body of oil resulting from the Exxon spill remains just south of Gore Point. The Coast Guard says patches of oil are 30 miles northeast of Kodiak's Marmot Island, but unofficial reports place oil patches as close as 10 miles. Lainey Welsh reports.
In anticipation of the approaching oil slick, Kodiak Islanders crowded into the high school auditorium again today for the third round of emergency preparedness meetings. With latest Coast Guard surveillance flights indicating an oil sheen nearing Marmot Island, boats, crews, containment, and cleanup gear are ready to go. Marmot Island, located near the northeast tip of Kodiak, is the home of Alaska's largest sea lion rookery. It's also close to some of Kodiak's more critical herring stocks. Jeff Steven, manager of the United Fishermen's Marketing Association, is organizing boat owners and crews for the cleanup operations.
We need vessels to be ready on immediate notice. That means fuel, groceries, skiffs, extra shots of crab line, gas cans, maybe several crab pots on board, anchors if you have them, throw on as much as you can. Vessels should be immediately ready to go support the 4 to 7 vessels that are leaving today. If the oil goes to them, we'll need to put more vessels with them. If the oil goes somewhere else, we'll need to send vessels to the areas where the oil goes. We may also need to relieve those vessels that have been out for some time. We cannot depend on a few. We should all be ready to rotate. With good luck, we won't see any of this. Please remember that we won't know for several weeks, however. Once again, please commit yourself to this effort. Please be ready to go.
Boats are ready to go, but many loose ends still need to be taken care of. Exxon has promised to assume all liability coverage for vessels and crews and to provide charter contracts for boat owners. And they've promised to set up boat cleaning stations. But so far, people have received no written confirmation, nor have they been able to talk with anyone from Exxon. Yesterday, four Exxon representatives met with city officials, but then they left Kodiak immediately. Fishermen like Dave Hernstein expressed frustration at the lack of input and availability of Exxon's people.
You got to know what you're going to be paying your crews. You got to know what kind of rate you're getting. And apparently they had a list and took it with them. And I think it's very specific information that needs to be known. If they're trying to talk with us as businessmen as well as fishermen, we need to have them stick around long enough to talk about. We're in the habit of making contracts with canneries and all other kind of entities. But you got to know some figures. You got to know what's going on. And I think for them to just come into town and jump ship and take off is not responsible.
Exxon says they'll have a company representative stationed on Kodiak Island as of today. Islanders feel they're running out of time and they won't wait around for Exxon to make good on stated commitments. City Mayor Bob Brody sums up the feeling of this island community.
We're not depending on Exxon, we're depending on ourselves.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Birds and animals outside Prince William Sound are beginning to feel the effects of oil. Exxon announced this morning that it's planning to open a rescue center in Seward. It hasn't opened yet, and Ron Smith from the Park Service response team says wildlife isn't all Exxon plans to clean.
They've also begun to establish seven cleaning facilities, actually they're calling them decontamination facilities, for vessels traveling through the oil slick, cleaning the oil off the boats when they pass through it. Those are going to be set up in Whittier, Cordova, Valdez, Homer, I'm trying to think of all of them, of course here in Seward, and possibly in Kodiak.
Even though oil has surrounded known bird and animal habitats, no animals have been brought into Seward for cleaning yet, but Smith knows there will be.
We're sure that as this thing progresses, we will begin to find birds and mammals, and we want to have a facility ready. We've also been contacted by a variety of people having a desire to volunteer their time and assistance in helping us clean birds and or other animals, probably sea otters, those kind of animals. So it's been pretty exciting, and when we get these things in place, we'll be extremely grateful.
He cautions that the cleaning facility is not in place yet and asks that potential volunteers please stay tuned to their radios. As soon as there's work to be done in Seward, Ron Smith will let us know. The state of Alaska today ordered the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company to assemble a 12-member oil spill response team to be on duty in Valdez 24 hours a day. The order gives Alyeska 3 days to comply. Otherwise, fines of up to $100,000 could follow. Alyeska already has announced plans to beef up its oil spill readiness in Valdez, but today's order by DEC Commissioner Kelso goes beyond that. By May 15th, the order requires Alyeska to be able to respond to any spills up to 10 million gallons within 2 hours anywhere within Prince William Sound. Alyeska may ask for a public hearing on the state requirements, but Kelso said the order would remain in effect during those hearings. Alyeska has increased the flow of oil in the Trans-Alaska pipeline to its regular output of more than 2 million barrels a day. The flow was cut back to about 800,000 barrels a day after the Exxon spill when the port was closed to tankers. Now, Alyeska spokesman Tom Brennan says about 4 tankers a day are being escorted into port, and the North Slope crude is flowing at full force.
It's a little bit over 2 million barrels a day. It started several days ago, and I think we reached full throughput the day before yesterday. We're still under the restrictions established by the state and the Coast Guard, but we're able to bring in a normal flow of tankers. We have 75 to 80 tankers normally in a month, and even with the amount of daylight we have now, we can get 3 or 4 tankers in a day, so we can actually stay ahead of schedule if necessary.
We reported yesterday that 3 skimmers have remained idle at the oil terminal, but Brennan says that equipment must remain at the dock as part of the current contingency plan, ready for use in case of another spill. The Prince William Sound Conservation Association doesn't support it, but there's a protest brewing on the East Coast. Connecticut State Representative Mike Mayott is launching a Boycott Exxon movement. He's been involved in environmental issues, but he says it's been from a nuts and bolts lawmaking point of view, not protests or boycotts. He isn't known for this sort of action.
The first way this idea came to me was when someone who's been involved with me, a friend of mine, worked in my campaigns in the past, told me that a few days ago he pulled into an Exxon station to get gas, and his wife was in the car with him, and she said, "No way are you buying gas in this station from this company with what happened in Alaska." And we started talking about that. We talked to others. I think there's a lot of sort of pent-up resentment and anger over this.
The target date for the boycott is May 2nd, but Mayott says that doesn't mean people have to buy gas from Exxon at other times. He claims he's already gotten support from legislators in other states, including New York. When you talk with people about the Exxon disaster, it's striking how many Alaskans have personal attachments to Prince William Sound. For some people, the sound's been the site of their most profound experiences of Alaska. Commentator John Howe spent a month there a couple of years ago. These are some of his observations.
Last night, a week after the wreck of the good ship Exxon Valdez, having successfully navigated the early stages of mourning, anger, denial, guilt, I realized I had entered the final stage when sorrow turns to prayer. So I got out my Prince William Sound journal, and I searched through it for memories of the wild creatures I'd seen there. August 20th, 1986. This morning we took the skiff up a tide channel into an inner salt lagoon with a salmon stream at its head. As we pushed slowly up the channel, a harbor seal streaked by underwater, not rising to look back at us until it was almost around the first bend. The stream was about 30 feet wide and almost solid with salmon, no more than a few inches between any two of them all the way across. Farther up, the forest closed in around white sandbars in deep, purest emerald green pools teeming with fish. From high up on the bank, from deep devil's club and ferns and low overhanging hemlock boughs came the loud snorting woof of a bear, then the sound of brush crashing and a glimpse of brown fur moving fast up the mountain. August 27th, Montague Island. Slow drizzle all day. Saw Stellar's Jay so wet its blue was soaked too dark to see. Many bedraggled eagles lurking on snags over the water. A fox sparrow, kingfishers, and a sharp-shinned hawk. All day, the eerie squawks and whistles and whirrings of thousands of seabirds, mostly murres and murrelets, floated through the mist across still water dappled by rain. August 29th, Night Island. Killer whales. 42 animals spread out over a half-square mile, two pods traveling together. An extended family? A tribe? I learned last night that each pod in Prince William Sound speaks its own dialect of the killer whale language. September 4th. Early evening in a small cove near Simpson Bay. Golden light glows through the feathers of a gull gliding by close overhead. Salmon leap, fall back with soft smacks on the water, crystal clear water, deepest blue. A cone-shaped avenue of light expands out across the water, flows sparkling toward snow-capped mountains and the setting sun. Floating, asleep on her back, her pup held tightly in her arms, a mother sea otter drifts gently towards us on an incoming tide. September 9th. This morning, from a small rocky island across from Columbia Glacier, we watched an oil tanker slide out of Valdez Narrows. It was one of those scenes Alaskans take pride in. Straight-lined, gleaming, metal, confident 20th century technology moving through a magnificent Alaska landscape. A fine scene to show anyone who doubts that oil development can happen here. We can drill for oil at the mouth of Bristol Bay. We can explore for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Watching the tanker move so purposefully, so dutifully out to sea, for a brief moment, I believed. I'll admit it, I bought the party line. It can't happen here, not in this perfect place.
The thoughts of Juno writer John Howe. And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Friday, April the 7th. We had reports tonight from John Greeley of KTOO in Juneau, Claire Richardson of KCHU in Valdez, and Lainey Welch of KMXT in Kodiak. Matt Kay was our Washington correspondent. Our commentator was John Howe. APRN's Peter Kenyon reported from Valdez and Sue Burris from Anchorage. Diana Derby is our engineer with production assistance from Larry Yarrow. Our special thanks go out tonight to Dave Hammock, his staff, and volunteers at KCHU in Valdez. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, promoting social progress and economic development for people throughout the state. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Good evening, stations. This is the Alaska Public Radio Network Actuality Service for this Friday, the 7th of April. We have some brand new material for you and some additional weekend material and some things to tell you about. But before we do that, I have to tell you about the engineers here. We just did a program that I think came out remarkably well, considering the...
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and the Sheraton Anchorage Hotel, the hospitality people. Thank you.
Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly. Key figures in Congress are using the example of the Exxon oil spill to block plans for the development of Anwar. And the governor introduces a plan to keep a major oil royalty lawsuit in the state. Good evening. I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, a controversy over otter rescues in Prince William Sound, and nerves strained to the breaking point as Kodiak waits for the spill. Following the nation's worst oil spill in Prince William Sound, key senators and members of Congress have put the brakes on development plans for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. As Joel Southern reports from Washington, Anwar will stay on hold while development supporters deal with a political oil slick.
The lead story in today's Washington Post, oil drilling legislation is shelved. Subhead, mishandling of spill reinforces skepticism about Arctic project. Key legislators like Chairman Bennett Johnston of the Senate Energy Committee and Chairman Walter Jones of the House Merchant Marine Committee are backing off their strong support of Anwar development, at least in the current political climate. After seeing TV accounts of the damage in Prince William Sound and after hearing Alaskans' angry claims of betrayal by the oil companies, Congress has decided it's time to reevaluate before proceeding to open up Anwar. Alaska Senator Frank Murkowski agrees.
For the time being, in spite of the fact that the two don't have a direct relationship, this isn't the time to bring up Anwar. You bring up legislation when the perception is favorable. It was favorable prior to the accident. It's not now.
Bennett Johnston and the Energy Committee reported out an Anwar bill just a few weeks ago. Chairman Jones planned to send one to the House floor by July 4th. Now both say they'll need to see proper safeguards in place before trying to open up the coastal plain. It's hard to decipher what Johnston's and Jones' actions mean for the fate of Anwar. Even for veteran observers like the Sierra Club's Tim Mahoney, chairman of the Environmentalist Alaska Coalition.
If they're just hunkering down and waiting for the winds to change, we want to kill the development bill. If the development bill is dead, we want to drive a stake through its heart, and we're not there yet. But Walter Jones and Bennett Johnston are reacting to a surge of public opinion that we may never have seen in this country behind an environmental disaster. This may be bigger than Three Mile Island. It may be bigger than the Santa Barbara oil spill. It is both a colossal evidence of an environmental disaster, and it is the oil companies having based their entire credibility on the idea that such a disaster could never happen.
Mahoney says environmentalists don't plan to let the oil spill fade from the public consciousness. He thinks it will be a long time before the oil industry can again claim a good safety record. That's also the view of Congressman George Miller, chairman of the House Subcommittee on Water Power and Offshore Energy Resources. Just back from viewing Prince William Sound, Miller today said it would be irresponsible to open Anwar to oil and gas development under the current discredited system for contingency planning. But as Congressman Don Young points out, that doesn't mean Miller or others are giving Anwar development a complete thumbs down.
George Miller's press conference today, he said, specifically to us, are you against Anwar? He said, no, I am not against Anwar. He's the chairman of the committee. Walter Jones, in fact, has told me personally that when it cools down, we're going to take another look at it with oil spill legislation. And, everybody's in this cheerfully on the environmental side thinking it's dead. It's not dead. It cannot be dead because there's no other source of energy.
And Young thinks the energy source argument is what will keep Anwar going despite fallout from the oil spill.
I just don't think it's dead this year. Again, it might be. If it is, we got another year. We got two more years. That's one of the blessings about having a good president understand. He stood by us. He said that this is absolutely necessary, and we'll just keep working on it. The opposite side of the coin is environmentalists are using this as a historical lever to try to discourage development of energy. Even with this new fusion-type programs coming out of Utah, they've already said they wouldn't support it. So where are you going to get your energy? I keep asking that. They can't give me an answer.
Another political pressure on Anwar development is the fact that the Bush administration is counting on lease sales for about $2 billion of revenue in the 1990 budget. That's presupposing any legislation that might pass Congress would allow the federal government 100% of the income from lease sales, which would not be likely. For Alaska Public Radio, I'm Joel Southern in Washington.
For 12 years, Alaska and the oil industry have been at court over the value of royalty oil coming out of the ground at Prudhoe Bay. A trial is scheduled to begin next year in Juneau Superior Court, with potential stakes in the billions of dollars. But a lawsuit filed by three Prudhoe Bay producers is seeking to move the main case out of Alaska. Now, Governor Cooper is asking the legislature to head off that possibility. John Greeley reports.
The governor is sponsoring legislation in the House that already has raised red flags among some politicians who champion the permanent fund dividend. It seeks to exempt from dividend payments any income derived from the royalty oil case if and when the courts find in Alaska's favor. Introduced Friday, the bill goes to the heart of arguments now before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. There, the oil companies are pleading they can't get a fair trial in Alaska on the royalty oil case because royalty oil feeds the permanent fund, and every judge and juror in Alaska qualifies for permanent fund dividends. A federal judge in Fairbanks thought he had enough of a conflict of interest to disqualify himself from the case, and then a visiting judge from Oregon found in the state's favor. Attorney General Doug Bailey says Alaska has a good defense against the claims raised by the oil companies, but his legal judgment is that winning the case is not worth the risk of losing it, and then seeing the main lawsuit, the one in which up to $2.6 billion could be at stake for the Treasury, delayed even longer and sent to another state for trial. So Bailey told reporters at a press conference he wants action by the legislature now.
The federal courts are likely to rule in the next few months. They're certainly likely to rule prior to the time that the next session starts. And if they rule that this case cannot be further processed in the state court, we will lose that case. And once it's gone, once we have been prohibited from hearing it, I simply don't know how we could ever get it back.
The bill that Bailey drafted and Cooper introduced was referred to three committees in the House on Friday. One committee co-chairman, Democrat Max Grunberg of Anchorage, maintains the Attorney General's office should not retreat from the lawsuit now in San Francisco. And Grunberg says if the bill Cooper sponsored gets to his Judiciary Committee, it will stay there for a while.
I think that there's very little merit in the oil company's position. I think there's a great deal of merit in the state's position. And I think the case, frankly, almost borders on a frivolous lawsuit, the federal case. And I'm not saying that lightly. And for us to take all of the Amerada Hess money and the earnings on that out of the dividend program at this point in time, when we haven't even begun to litigate the other case, is way premature.
Grunberg says he's familiar with the issues raised in the industry lawsuit because he's a trial lawyer himself. But Governor Cooper is also a lawyer, and he's worried enough about the suit to ask for help from the legislature. In a letter to House Speaker Sam Cotton, Cooper said the cost to future dividend checks by taking the royalty oil income out of the dividend stream was very small, perhaps $6 to $8 a year. Even if it's as big as the oil companies claim, that is $70 a year per Alaskan, the governor says that's a small price to pay for making sure the Alaska court system is not disqualified from hearing the most important legal fight facing the state today. As yet, no legislative hearing scheduled on the issue. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
The Coast Guard and Department of Environmental Conservation are investigating an oil spill at the Alyeska pipeline terminal. The Coast Guard says 6 barrels of oil leaked from a valve on the tanker Keystone Canyon around 5 this morning. The Coast Guard says an oil containment boom had been placed around the ship before loading began. That's one of the new requirements imposed by the state after the March 24th oil spill. The loading of oil's been suspended while the discharged oil's being cleaned up. Exxon says it doubled its oil collection rate over the weekend, picking up more than 2,000 barrels from Prince William Sound on Saturday and Sunday. So far, Exxon says 18,000 barrels have been recovered, and some 40% of the spill may have evaporated or dispersed naturally. Claire Richardson reports the remaining oil is believed to be divided fairly evenly between the Gulf of Alaska, Prince William Sound, and the shoreline.
Exxon spokesman Don Cornett says the company has hired an archaeologist to screen beaches for historical or archaeological value before cleanup crews are sent in. The first shore cleanup is targeted for Naked Island. Cornett says Exxon has been having trouble finding high-pressure hoses to scrub the shores with and has asked help from France, the site of the Amoco Cadiz spill over 10 years ago.
We have scoured the countryside in the U.S. I knew that there were some on the East Coast, but they're not nearly in the numbers. When they had the Cadiz spill, Amoco Cadiz spill in France, They used them extensively, and they built large numbers of them, hundreds of them. And yes, we've asked them to ship them in. And we will start using them when this committee that is directing the onshore cleanup says this is a spot where you can use them, and the oil is off the water enough in this area that you can begin to clean the shoreline.
Some scientists worry that high-pressure cleaning techniques may strip the beaches of all life, but Exxon says it will use safer techniques to clean sensitive areas. The leading edge of the spill appears to be breaking up in rougher weather out in the Gulf of Alaska. And Lynn Crystal with the National Weather Service in Valdez says the winds are good news for Cordova.
From Cape Suckling to Gore Point, which is basically the area where the oil is right now, we have a gale warning of east winds to 45 knots, seas to 20 feet. Now, obviously, this is having a big effect on diminished breaking up that oil.
Jim Hayden with the Department of Environmental Conservation says the ferry Aurora is heading for Herring Bay today, where workers will skim oil off the top of the water.
We're still concentrating on harbor cleanup. We're not presently going to do any beach cleanup. Going to wait until the oil is either flushed out naturally or picked up by skimmers before we concentrate on the beaches. The booms seem to be holding well in San Juan and in the other bays that we have prioritized. There, however, is one problem boom, and that's the Navy boom in San Juan. They're still trying to deploy that. The anchors seem to be too light to hold the boom.
Hayden adds Exxon had stopped some skimming operations because of the winds, but Exxon was not able to confirm that. Hayden says if the storm is severe, more beaches will be impacted. However, he added, much of the oil has thinned out and is dispersing in the Gulf of Alaska. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Sheila Nickerson says biologists are still concerned with the millions of marine birds heading to Prince William Sound in the next few weeks.
We have at this particular time vast numbers of returning marine birds which have been out on the open ocean until this time, and it is a critical life stage for them because they will be nesting. And right now many of the breeding colony areas are in jeopardy, and of course these areas such as Marmot Island and the Barren Islands and the Chiswell Islands are also haul-out areas for sea lions.
Meanwhile, the Coast Guard says there are still no plans to use military troops for beach cleanup, but the Department of Defense will be relied on for logistic support. The new federal director of the cleanup, Coast Guard Admiral Paul Yost, has ordered six more Coast Guard cutters in the area to help with the cleanup. Yost has also ordered command posts to be set up in Seward and Homer. The Alaska Oil Spill Joint Task Force assessment team is surveying several spill sites today. In Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
Governor Cooper today gave Kodiak high marks for its oil spill preparations, but the uncertainty over when or if the oil's going to hit is taking its toll on the community. Charlene Perrin prepared this report.
First off, I'd like to thank the people of Kodiak for and congratulate you for going out aggressively and taking the kinds of steps that will minimize the damage if the oil hits your shore. We realize that a lot of these efforts have got to be local, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate it.
Governor Cooper and Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Dennis Kelso assured the audience at today's emergency committee meeting the state is committed to providing funds and technical staff to help Kodiak set up a defense against the oil. Kelso said if there's a silver lining to the Prince William Sound tragedy, it's the remarkable teamwork and energy he's seen working with the people in Valdez, Cordova, and now on the Kenai Peninsula and Kodiak. In contrast to the warm words coming from the governor's office, some members of the audience today expressed frustration. One person asked if the state planned to file criminal charges against Exxon.
You know, if I spilled 5 gallons of oil down in the harbor and I didn't pick it up, I figured I'd go to jail. You know, if I said I wouldn't pick it up, if I was too busy and I couldn't take care of it right now. And it just, I'm just waiting for, I mean, I know we're supposed to be nice, they're Exxon, and there's all this compliments being passed back and forth about how good everybody is, but hell, I think the skipper is getting taking all the responsibility for this, you know, as far as the news reports are going and as far as the rest of the world is concerned, and I don't think there's been enough brought up about Exxon's responsibility to hire competent people, and that Exxon is responsible, and why isn't there some Exxon people in jail with $1 million bail?
The governor said the state would press charges when it had enough evidence to justify an indictment. The focus then turned from Exxon and on to local preparations for a cleanup. Priority lists have been prepared of Kodiak's critical areas. A skimmer is in town, and a Navy crew to operate it is expected any day now. Boom has been ordered from all over the country. Kodiak has booms 3 deep protecting 3 critical bays on Afognak Island. Boom has been sent to the northern villages of Port Lyons and Yuzinki, and materials are being sent to Marmot Island, which is closest to the oil. Pilot Bob Stanford says that's not enough. Stanford has been flying over Prince William Sound this past week. He described what he's seen over there.
The skimming operations, they're ridiculous. Nothing, it's not stopping it. The booms, these booms are worthless. I've seen booms in every little bite on Night Island, in all over that sound.
Bob,
I've flown it for 8 years.
You have a suggestion on what we can do?
Let me finish, please.
Well,
let me finish, please.
Sure.
The booms aren't stopping the material. I'm not an expert. I'm just going to give you what my eyes have witnessed. There's as much oil behind the booms as there is beginning. I've seen one area that possibly is going to contain that oil, and that's the fishermen of Cordova that stopped it in San Juan. They've got at least 5 layers of booms there, at least, and they have perfect weather. You must remember, it's inside waters. It's flat calm. It's nothing like it's going to be here.
Stanford recommended the emergency committee move swiftly to keep Kodiak protected.
They showed you a chart of where the oil is. As of 7 a.m. yesterday, we've had a northeast blowing, I believe, for the last day. I'd like to see it this morning. It's coming. When it goes to the beach, it doesn't stop. It just doesn't sit there and, okay, it's over in that area. It just sits in the bay until the weather changes and comes out. We must pick it up. We've got to stop it. We've got to pick it up, and we've got to catch it before it destroys this island.
There was criticism from others that Kodiak is not adequately prepared to dispose of oil, and people complained about having to wait in limbo on volunteer lists. The emergency committee is working round the clock, ordering equipment and organizing the community, but being in a state of perpetual anticipation can be trying. For days now, the town has been poised for an impending crisis, while the oil just hangs there in the Gulf of Alaska. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ordered bird rescue crews last week to stop capturing live sea otters. More than half the otters brought into the rehabilitation center have died, and officials want to tighten control in the hope that rescue efforts can be better directed. But some rescue crews claim the result could be more dead otters. Steve Heimel reports.
By now it's a familiar story. When Exxon's response seemed to be going nowhere, the locals tried to find a better way, got an okay, and went to work. That's how the oil was headed off at Sawmill Bay. And that's how Cordova bookstore owner and kayak guide Kelly Weaverling came to command a fleet of 28 fishing boats rescuing birds hit by the spill.
And I initially regarded this deployment as only the initial deployment. Beyond that, I wanted to get a relief boat for each section. An airplane, a spotter airplane for each area, can locate birds and distressed mammals, and also transfer those birds and mammals with more dispatch than the boats. So, I mean, this is just an initial deployment as I saw it. I wanted to make the units even more effective.
The fleet covers 7 regions with 4 boats in each region. They leapfrog from beach to beach, picking up all the dead bodies they can find so they're not eaten by predators, and trying to rescue living birds. But Weaverling says they could not pass up a troubled sea otter.
One of the bird people collected that otter. We couldn't in all conscience let an oiled otter be there while we were out collecting birds. Later on, he collected another otter. After we'd seen his technique, I began to collect an otter. The two of us basically collected 7 otters that day.
But within days, the fleet was called off. At first, Weaverling says it was because the Valdez Rescue Facility couldn't handle the load.
I got a phone call from the Otter Rescue Center here in Valdez to instruct my fleet to not capture any more live otters and deliver them because their facility could not handle it. I gave a message to our radio dispatcher to get that word to my fleet, and I flew to Valdez to find out what was going on. I came, I saw the otter facility, and frankly, it is woefully inadequate. I don't know who ever thought when they put that thing together that, I mean, there's no way it could possibly handle all the oiled otters that were going to be collected within over 1,000 square mile oiled area of ocean.
The center was being moved and expanded, but Weaveling says simple multiplication said his crews could be delivering far more otters than it could handle within a couple of days. So he convinced Exxon to build another one in Cordova. But then the Fish and Wildlife Service stepped in. They stopped Center Director Randy Davis from relieving his overcrowding by shipping out a group of otters to an aquarium in Vancouver, Canada. They said the new center ought to be in Seward. And they also told Weaverling his crews ought to stick to birds and bodies and let Exxon vessels and Fish and Wildlife Service vessels take care of the otters. Everett Robinson Wilson heads the federal effort.
We realize other people probably could catch otters, but we really fear that we may be doing more damage to them than helping them.
The techniques used by both groups are similar. They stalk the animal and net it. Weaverling says his crews do all their work on land. Wilson says that effort could be futile.
Usually those animals that are on the beach are so far gone that I'm not sure that, you know, even sending them in is doing them any good. In other words, those are a lot of the ones that are dying.
As with much of this effort, the science behind the decision is uncertain. Lab results of autopsies on the otters that died at the rescue center are not back yet. Post-mortem work on three that died after being shipped to SeaWorld in San Diego does show liver and kidney damage, indicating they were poisoned by the oil. Wilson says it's a tough decision, but he thinks they need to do all they can to keep from stressing the otters. Weaverling says he won't break the law, but he will keep trying to save the otters somehow.
I can't stop, you know, I just can't stop myself. I feel a moral obligation not to try and save every otter, but to try and save every otter, every bird, everything that you possibly can. I think it behooves me as a person on this planet not to allow death to occur when I can stop it.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
The number one priority in Kachemak Bay right now is the Tutka Bay Salmon Hatchery. Hatchery-raised fish account for nearly 90% of all the pink salmon caught by commercial fishermen in Lower Cook Inlet. If oil is sucked into Tutka Lagoon, it could spell disaster for the hatchery and the fishermen who depend on it. Joe Gallagher reports.
We'll meet you right on the beach there where we were yesterday. Roger.
Yeah, that's Roger, and it looks like we'll be going ahead and deploying the full diamond-shaped perimeter around the lagoon like we talked about, okay?
Hey, Roger, there. Okay, we'll be out there and...
Fish and game biologist Nick Dudiak steered his Boston Whaler into Tutka Bay Lagoon as the tide was coming in. Just behind him were two seine boats, Al Ray Carroll's The Douglas River and John McClain's Capture. Both were carrying 1,000 feet of boom. The bright blue sea curtain is designed to stop the flow of oil should it enter the waters surrounding the hatchery. The plan called for two set net skiffs, operated by Dave Adams and Jim McGrath, to help ferry the boom off the seine boats and over to the hatchery pens. Dudiak explained what he had in mind as workers gathered on a beach inside the lagoon.
That's the way to be ahead of the tide.
Really.
That service will ride over.
And we can't get in yet, or?
No. Okay. No, it'll be a little while. What we plan on doing is they went out to get a few sections of boom.
Uh-huh.
We'll try to get it semi-rigged on the skiff, and as soon as we can get the set net skiffs in there, we'll go on in,
Okay. Get
that deployed, and by that time we might have enough water depth to get the skiffs back out. And we'll have the seiners come in here at that point in time and stage out of this shallow beach.
Okay, great. That sounds
we'll just
great.
Work back and forth because it's another hour before they can get in.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, I think we'll work it that way.
Good.
Normally they stamp it on the inplate too.
Each section.
The operation went off like clockwork. Specialist Gary Baldwin of Seattle was in charge of assembling the boom. The bulky vinyl-coated curtain comes in 100-foot sections that hook onto each other. Within minutes, the boom was out of its wrapping and on its way to the hatchery pen.
Got a guide on the bottom?
Okay, huh?
Yeah,
look at that.
Gary Baldwin has plenty of experience with oil spill cleanup. He dealt with it as a member of the Coast Guard for 10 years and now works for a private environmental services company. But he's never seen anything quite like what he's encountered in Alaska the past 2 weeks.
I don't think anybody's done anything this extensive before. This is the largest that in the history of the United States. So we were on the 85 spill in Port Angeles. And I came off in December. I was over at Ocean Shores on that spill with our company. But this is going to be hopefully the largest we'll ever see, I hope.
How confident are you that what you're setting up will work?
That's a hard one to answer. let's rely on nature to help us out here. There's no sure answer to anything. They found in the other places that the boom ain't working. Hopefully by diverting out at the mouth of the channel there and this configuration around the pins that we can fight it off, but there's no sure answer in this game.
Helping out with the work at the hatchery was Pete Velsko, who's the manager. Velsko has worked at Tutka Bay for 13 years and knows more about the operation of the hatchery than anyone else.
It's starting to be our critical time. It's several weeks before fry emergence. Fry are still in the hatchery. They will start emerging. Probably we'll have some emergence the latter week of April, but generally our major emergence is about the first week or two in May. That's when we really get swamped. So this is not really a good timing for us because we're in preparation of being out here on the floats, getting our fish food supplies delivered, getting ready to get our seasonal personnel on. And there'll be a lot of transporting of fish from the hatchery to the floats by around the first week of April. If this should last another couple of weeks, or we should get impacted for any length of time, especially as we start to move into May, it could be real bad for us as far as trying to get our work done and trying to deal with the oil.
We're gonna settle it right here on the neck and one of these skips can just kind of pull.
At the end of the day, the Tutka hatchery was surrounded by a diamond-shaped stretch of boom. How it will work should the oil show up is anyone's guess, but Nick Dudiak was pleased with the work done and grateful for the help he received.
This, I think, would be the way to do it if we have to do this in the future here in other areas of Ketchumak Bay. Let's just hope that this is all just precaution and that we will never see oil in the Ketchumak Bay area.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Monday, the 10th of April. We had reports tonight from John Greeley of KTOO in Juneau, Claire Richardson of KCHU in Valdez, and Joe Gallagher of KBBI in Homer. Our Washington correspondent is Joel Southern. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Valdez.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by the Tundra Times, keeping you up to date on statewide Native issues at 274-2512, and Charter North Hospital, providing treatment for mental health and addictive disease. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.